President, we are all here getting ready to leave after we fund the government and return home to our families. We get pretty excited about this time of year, thinking about the holidays to come. We're heading home to our loved ones. We know there will be extended family gatherings. There will be games with the children. There will be exchanges of presents. And there will be food. There will be awesome food. Ham, turkey, all kinds of wonderfully crafted vegetable dishes. And there will be so much that we can drink. Oh, yes, there will be wine varieties. There will be eggnog. Perhaps some of it will be spiked. There will be carbonated apple juice or cranberry juice for the kids. We'll put it into glasses. We'll have toast. We will really celebrate life. We'll celebrate life with a roof over our head, with our loved ones close by, and with our cupboards well stocked. But also in these holidays, there will be time for reflection in every religious tradition. And for those of us who are fortunate to have that roof over our head and food in the cupboard and our loved ones close by, we will recognize that for so many, that is not the case. For so many here in the United States who, by virtue of economic conditions or the ravages of disease or mental afflictions, they will not have a roof over their head. They may not have family members close by. They may not even have a cupboard, let alone one that's well stocked. And we'll ponder our responsibility to try to improve those conditions. And we will ponder the landscape across the broader globe, knowing that in many places, people have been so ravaged by natural disasters, so affected by conflict and war. I'm sure we'll see programs and commentary about Sudan, where millions have been displaced by civil war and by drought and by famine, or in Burma, where so many are suffering escalating violence, or in Ukraine, where people are brutalized by Putin's invasion, the efforts to defend their country. No matter where you look, there is no shortage of suffering. But the place that weighs heaviest on my heart this season is the Middle East. We have the families of Israel continuing to grieve the loss of 1,200 of their own loved ones on October 7th, 2023. We have families in Israel that continue to not know the fate of their loved ones taken hostage, whether they are alive, whether they are dead, whether they're being cared for, whether they're suffering. Will they be released? There will be an empty chair at the table. The victims in Israel weigh on my heart, but the Palestinian victims also weigh on my heart. Individuals on the West Bank, Palestinians who suffer from decades of occupation, of the economic constraints and indignity that come from checkpoints, that come from land lost to settlements and to outposts, to olive orchards bulldozed down, to lives lost and injuries suffered from increasing violence by settlers against Palestinian villagers. But by far the most devastated communities are the Palestinian communities in Gaza, both because of the extraordinary level of devastation, and it weighs on my heart because of the connection between the United States and Israel, our close connection with our ally, where we share security strategies, where we provide economic and military assistance. We share intelligence on the issues of the world. We are so closely connected that we are connected to the devastation in Gaza. Since October 7th, 2023, more than 45,000 Palestinians in Gaza have died. More than 100,000 have been severely injured. The vast bulk of those injured and those who have died are women and children and seniors, people who have no connection whatsoever to Hamas that conducted the raids on October 7th of 2023. The devastation is massive. This same picture taken in North Gaza could be almost copied for community after community from north to south of Gaza. Of the 2.1 million people, the Palestinians in Gaza, some 1.9 million, almost everyone that is without a home, either because their home has been blasted into smithereens or because they have been forcibly moved to a different location within Gaza, forced relocation. A year ago, Senator Van Hollen and I went to Rafah Gate. We hoped to get inside Gaza to see with our own eyes and talk to people and understand better the devastation. But what we heard a year ago was that all the fundamentals for a normal community were devastated. Shelter, I've already spoken to, the 1.9 million people relocated either because they were forced to flee or because their home no longer exists. That the phone networks were down, the cell networks were down. That the internet networks were down. And even if they were up, people had very little opportunity to recharge their cell phones because there wasn't electricity. So the power was down. The transportation was down because many roads were impassable. Food was in short supply, driving malnutrition a year ago. Clean water was often unavailable a year ago. The transportation was down because many roads were impassable. Food was in short supply, driving malnutrition a year ago. Clean water was often unavailable a year ago. A year ago, Senator Van Hollen and I could not get into Gaza. Reporters have not been allowed into Gaza except for very carefully monitored short visits monitored by the Netanyahu government. Humanitarian organizations were having a hard time getting in and often had to do a very careful exchange of an exact number for exact number coming out. But as we stood there at that gate, a couple doctors came out. And I spent some time talking to them. And one of them was a burn specialist who described how hard it was to treat many of the massive burns that he had witnessed. The other was a bone doctor. And he said, I can treat the broken bones, but I can't necessarily treat the soft tissue damage that comes from the shock waves that emanate from all the explosions taking down the buildings. The impact, he said, of the blast radius in terms of the shock waves was even greater than the physical damage. And we were able to talk to humanitarian organizations of aid workers who had been in Gaza, and they said, understand this, that we are seasoned workers who have been in the worst places in the world. We have been in Yemen. We have been on the front line of Ukraine. We have been in Sudan. Nothing compares to the devastation in Gaza. That was a year ago. I was particularly affected by hearing about the challenge of mothers. Mothers receive our attention, particularly when they are carrying babies, because all our efforts go to make sure that that delivery, that child will come safely into the world, healthy into the world, the mother will be cared for. But what we heard from the humanitarian organizations were that hunger was driving malnutrition. Malnutrition made people more susceptible to disease. And for mothers, it meant increases in miscarriages, increases in stillbirth, increases in very low birth weight babies, increases in the difficulty of mothers breastfeeding their children because they were too malnourished to produce milk, and babies getting sick because when formula was used, if available, the water might be contaminated. Think about the children you've brought into the world, that your wife or your partner has brought into the world, and how horrific it would be to see those circumstances. This time of year is a time of year in my spiritual tradition where we think a lot about the challenges Mary went through. She and Joseph were traveling from Galilee to Bethlehem, and they were traveling there at the time that Mary was very pregnant with Jesus because a census had been ordered by the Roman Emperor Caesar Augustus, and they were required to be there and report to Joseph's ancestral home of Bethlehem. Traveling the roads when pregnant, very hard. And then they weren't able to find a room in Bethlehem. And yet, Mary went into labor and delivered in a barn. Not ideal circumstances. And because this time of year, and because we think about that story so much, the mothers in Gaza, their conditions so much worse. It's something we can connect with. And now the children in Gaza, they're entering the second year in this devastation. Some have some format of school, but many do not. Now we here in America know, we know what COVID did to interrupt the education of our children. Some did well with tutors. Many suffered isolation. Many suffered setbacks in what they learned. Many are still carrying that challenge forward as they seek education. So we can also connect to the children of Gaza who have had their education, their life so disrupted, a life disrupted by lack of food and water, instability, lack of safety. 2 weeks ago, an ambassador from the Middle East drew attention to a part of Gaza in worse shape than the rest of Gaza. And he referred to this area, was specifically, it's North Gaza. And where is North Gaza? You have North Gaza, Northern Gaza, and Southern Gaza separated by the Netzarim corridor. It travels from Israel to the Mediterranean Sea. But then within Northern Gaza, you have Gaza City and then communities. Bet Lahia, Bet Hanan, and Jabalah. And in those communities, he said, there's 65,000 people who are starving to death because food cannot get in. 65,000 people starving. Now, we know the food conditions have been horrific in Gaza for a year. But in this case, sustained prevention of food getting in, and people are starving. Well, he asserted this, so I asked a visiting official from another Middle Eastern country about this, and he emphasized, yes. Yes, he said, there are, in fact, 65,000 people or more starving in northern Gaza, isolated from the rest of the world. Okay, well, that's two officials, but that's a big thing to say. But then this came out. Gaza Humanitarian Access Snapshot number 8. It is co-signed by 30 organizations, organizations like Save the Children, like CARE, like Mercy Corps, and 27 others. And what do they say in this report? They say 65 to 75,000 people are trapped without food, water, electricity, or reliable health care. That's a direct quote from the report of these 30 humanitarian organizations. It goes on to say humanitarian aid has been almost entirely blocked for 60 days. It goes on to say that only three hospitals remain partially operational with restricted access, very little health care. It says the population faces imminent risks of disease, starvation, and violence without urgent relief. Without urgent relief. I called up Cindy McCain. We know Cindy well here. Cindy McCain is the executive director of the World Food Program. She is the spouse of our former deceased colleague, John McCain. And I said to her, is this right? Are 65,000 people isolated in North Gaza for week after week after week, no deliveries of food or virtually none? And she said, yes. She said, yes, that is the case. And she didn't just say to me, she also talked about Gaza more broadly. And she said, we can no longer sit by and just allow these people to starve to death. Children, especially, she said, are starving to death. The height of malnutrition, the height of hunger with that region is unbelievably horrible. In November, the United Nations made 41 attempts to deliver aid to this section, North Gaza, to the besieged people trapped in North Gaza. 37 of the 41 attempts were blocked by the Netanyahu government. Four other deliveries were not blocked, but were troubled. Here is the situation. A year ago, we heard that if there isn't sufficient food, chaos will ensue because starving people will storm whatever truck there is that has food because they are desperate. The trucks won't be able to make it to the warehouse, or if they do make it to the warehouse will be sacked. We are now in the very condition that the humanitarian organizations told us would happen. So very little food being allowed in, what is being allowed in, can't be distributed in any significant organized fashion, and people are starving. And even if those four truckloads could have been at the warehouse and distributed, too little food, microscopic amount of food for the 65,000 people who are there. So, here we are now. Gaza's destruction, this destruction that we saw on that previous chart, this destruction, this is carried out by American bombs. This is how we are complicit in this situation. It is our munitions that are being used by the Israeli Defense Forces to produce this result. We are connected, and therefore we are morally connected to the situation in Gaza. Our weapon packages have included 50,000 120-millimeter high-explosive mortar rounds. Our provisions have included more than 32,000 120-millimeter tank rounds, more than 14,000 2,000-pound bombs and 6,500 500-pound bombs and hundreds of 250-pound bombs. Think about a 2,000-pound bomb. This is like the biggest bomb. And the New York Times described how, when it's dropped, it is designed to break fortified military bunkers. It will create a massive crater 40 to 50 feet wide. And when it explodes, it will shatter, and I quote, into razor-sharp fragments that can kill or incapacitate people over several hundred feet. You kind of get the feeling how any bomb like that is indiscriminate. Whether it's dropped on the intended building or it falls somewhere further afield, it kills a tremendous number of civilians. We are providing those bombs. Now, the Biden administration suspended the delivery of 200-pound bombs to the Netanyahu government because of that, and also suspended the 500-pound bombs. But the Wall Street Journal reported in July that the delivery had been restored of the 500-pound bombs. The point here is we continue to be deeply connected and tied to this devastation in Gaza. And it's not just the devastation of civilians, it's also American law, and it's also international law. National Security Memorandum 20, a process that was created because of the work of my colleague, Senator Van Hollen, says this: it is reasonable to assess, the report on this says, it's reasonable to assess that defense articles covered have been used by Israeli security forces inconsistent with international humanitarian law and the obligations for mitigating civilian harm. And so, what have we done? It was last February, now 10 months ago, that a group of us called on the United States for Operation Gaza Relief. We must at least provide massive amounts of humanitarian aid so people are not starving in Gaza. We have that responsibility. If we are urging Israel to provide the aid, which is the best strategy, but they do not do it, we have the obligation to provide it. And we did so little. We have the most massive sea lift capability in the world, and we didn't use a single bit of it to address a humanitarian crisis in Gaza. We have two hospital ships that have 1,000 beds each, and we did not move them into the Mediterranean to help out. We did not encourage other nations to provide their hospital ships. Now, we did do one modest thing. We did a floating pier that operated intermittently from May to July that had all kinds of problems breaking up in the waves. It provided, ultimately, at the best estimate, enough food for people of Gaza for a week. Not at all addressing the magnitude of the challenge. We had a responsibility to provide help independent of any other cessation of hostilities, and we failed. And yes, we pressed for a cessation of hostilities, we pressed for a ceasefire, and I applaud the administration for doing so. But while that failed, we also failed. We, America, failed in our responsibility to provide relief to the humanitarian suffering on which we are so closely connected. Our own law says that if our aid is impeded, as it has been by the Netanyahu government, that we cannot provide arms. But we have been violating our own law. 620I, no assistance shall be furnished under this act, the Arms Export Control Act, to any country when it's made known to the president that the governor of such country prohibits or otherwise restricts directly or indirectly the transport or delivery of United States humanitarian assistance. We have a moral responsibility and we have a legal responsibility. So we must do more. We must do more in the remaining weeks of this administration. We must do more in the opening year of the next administration, because these issues of moral responsibility, these issues of international law, do not depend on who sits in the Oval Office. So as we stand here about to go home and celebrate with our big plates of food and our full pitchers of wine, as we read our cards calling for peace in the world, as we offer our prayers, let us not forget those who suffer in the Middle East. Let us not forget the families who lost their family members on October 7th in Israel. Let us not forget the families in Israel whose hostages, whose family members are still held hostage. Let us not forget those on the West Bank suffering the afflictions of local violence. But most of all, let us not forget the victims in Gaza and do all we can under our moral responsibility, under our legal responsibility, to come to their aid. Thank you, Mr. President.